go ahead and start.
I'll let you go ahead and begin. Yeah.
Okay. As you can tell from the program, I'm Dr. Toussaint Bernard Toussaint from Benedictine University, which is just outside of Chicago in Lyle, Illinois, right next to the neighborhood. Heard of that. Well, let's start with the obvious. The news for some time has not been very good. Our banking system is in serious trouble. Some of our largest corporations are in bankruptcy or on the verge of it. The housing market is a disaster with a record number of home foreclosures. The stock market has collapsed. Our pensions funds have been severely depleted. Our universities are suffering from losses in endowment funds. Unemployment is reaching record highs. Many states are running huge deficits and turning to the federal government to bail them out. The federal government itself is running up a national debt to an unprecedented and unsustainable level. At the same time, people are rapidly losing confidence in our government. Just as a kind of footnote, I'm going to bring this up, but I was driving here last night or yesterday, and I heard on the radio that our most recent former governor, who has just indicted on 19 counts of fraud. I don't know if you're from Illinois, but I'm from Illinois, where the governors really do make the license plates. In fact, three of our last seven, not including the one who's indicted, have gone to prison. So three out of seven, if this one goes to prison, that'd be four out of seven. That's more than 50% of our most recent governors have ended in prison. There's a question of possibly indicting the senator that he appointed, their most recent governor appointed, indicting him on perjury. It doesn't take a while for you to figure out there's something wrong in the state of Illinois. In fact, something's wrong with the whole state, what we like to proudly call the state of Lincoln. That's just one particular example. I'm sure you could find many others. For some years, we have witnessed the breakdown of our social institutions, our educational system, our political system, of marriage, of the family, of personal relations. Well, why? Why is this all happening? I would argue that this is a result of the loss of moderation. While teaching a class and explaining the role of the monasteries in the Middle Ages to students, I happened to mention that the monks practice self-denial. To my shock, a student raised his hand and very innocently asked, "What's self-denial?" I realized that this is not a term that you hear very often anymore. It's not part of our modern vocabulary. The idea of voluntarily giving up some enjoyment, pleasure, to develop our self-control is not only not a popular idea, indeed we live in an age of self-indulgence and self-gratification. We call it consumerism, and both business and the media are constantly promoting it for their own profits. You don't see ads telling you not to buy our product, whether you need it or not. From ancient times through the Middle Ages, moderation was a core virtue of nearly every system of ethics. While the concept varied from one system to another, the basic meaning of moderation was living reasonably, that is, in harmony with reality. With the coming of the Enlightenment, the principle of moderation began to disappear from the writings of philosophers. While it remained in religious literature, it faded from the consciousness of people who increasingly turned for guidance to the secular world. The meaning of freedom changed from self-control, self-rule, self-restraint to self-indulgence. My students tell me that freedom means being able to do whatever you feel like. Well, this is exactly the opposite of Plato's ideal of a just society or of a just man. Doing what you feel like. In other words, the feelings rule. In all of this, in Plato's Republic, moderation is a key principle. Of course, the idea of moderation did not start with Plato. It's deeply rooted in Greek tradition. Well, the early atomist, Democritus of Abdera, tells us we should seek cheerfulness by avoiding the extremes of excess or deficiency. In other words, what Aristotle would call the mean. And another saying of Democritus, pleasure should be chosen according to moderation. Again, moderation increases pleasure. Note the connection here, though, between moderation and pleasure. It's a kind of a hedonistic approach. You moderate pleasures to enjoy them more. A person who eats chocolate all the time gets tired of it and doesn't enjoy it anymore, so you moderate just to maximize your enjoyment of it. Plato's conception of moderation is rather derived from the Pythagorean theorem, namely that virtue is harmony. Thus we read quite clearly in the Republic, quote, "I must go on," I replied, "and view from here, yet sobriety bears more likeness to a kind of concord and harmony than the other virtues do. How so? Soberness is a kind of beautiful order and continence of certain pleasures and appetites, as they say, using the phrase master of himself, or as we would call it, self-mastery. The term soberness in this translation of the Greek text is sophrosyne, which is usually translated as temperance or moderation. It is the third virtue in the just state or the just man. Plato goes on to discuss the meaning of the term master of himself, or self-mastery. For instance, he observes, if a man is master of himself, then he must also be a slave to himself. He concludes, no, the real meaning is that the soul of man within him has a better part and a worse part. And the expression of self-mastery means the control of the worse part by the naturally better part. These two elements of harmony and self-mastery are both essential to moderation, at least for Plato. Moderation is not just any kind of control, but a proper order. He says again in the Republic, "Do you see then," said I, "that our intuition was not a bad one just now that discerned a likeness between soberness and a kind of harmony? Yet, soberness or moderation extends literally through the entire gamut throughout, bringing about a unison in the same chant, just as in music, a harmony, so that we should be quite right in affirming this unanimity to be soberness, the concord of the naturally superior and inferior, as to which ought to rule both in the state and in the individual." In the Republic, moderation is depicted as the harmony of the three parts under the rule of reason, the higher part. You see this in the state, the philosopher king, or in the individual who is ruled by his reason. This is crucial because it is the disruption of this harmony, the lack of moderation, that leads to the destruction of the just state of the Republic. Plato describes the fall of the Republic and then shows how each successive state deteriorates into a worse one due to lack of moderation. Each successive state is defined by a dominant trait. When its dominant trait grows to excess, when it is no longer controlled with moderation, then the state falls. The Republic falls because even the wisest make mistakes. Judging by perception rather than reason, that dichotomy between appearances and reality, the rulers choose the wrong type to succeed them. Some ill-bred come to power. These ill-bred are not guided by reason, but by spirit and appetites. Spirit in the sense of Plato uses it, the aggressive, the emotions. Thus the harmony of the higher part ruling the lower parts is broken. No longer guided by reason, these new rulers demand the right to own property. A struggle ensues between them and the remaining rulers who are still devoted to virtue. A compromise is reached, and the rulers are allowed to own property. Thus the republic deteriorates into a democracy where honor replaces wisdom as the key virtue. At first, the desire for wealth is restrained by honor, the desire to be honorable, and respect for virtue. However, gradually the desire for wealth grows. Without the restraint of reason, it can't be stopped. By and by, then, says Plato, they push ahead with their money making, and the more they value money, the less they value virtue. In truth, we may imagine riches and virtue as always balanced in scales against each other. And when riches are honored more in a city, virtue and the good people are less honored than the rich. As wealth becomes valued more than honor, the Constitution is rewritten so that only the wealthy may rule. When the rule of wealth replaces the rule of honor, oligarchy has replaced democracy. When wealth is admired more than wisdom or virtue, the rulers are chosen by their wealth. The rulers are picked according to, you have to have a certain amount of property, a certain amount of wealth in order to be part of the government. Plato compares this city to a ship on which the pilot is chosen for his wealth rather than his ability to navigate. Everything is judged by money. Education is no longer directed to promoting virtue, but to increasing one's earning power. Does that sound familiar? Technical training. Teach them to get jobs. What's the use of the liberal arts? At first, the oligarch is restrained, of course, by his desire for wealth, so he's thrifty. There's a certain restraint built in. If you're trying to get wealthy, you can't spend everything that comes in. But eventually, he wants to enjoy the fruits of his wealth. And now, he must constantly increase his wealth. Well, we have already clearly seen, says Plato, that to honor riches and at the same time to acquire enough temperance is a thing impossible for the citizens of a city if they must of necessity neglect one of the two. So in the oligarchies, by overlooking or even encouraging intemperance, they have sometimes compelled men not ignoble to become paupers. They lend out money. They encourage people to borrow more, to pay off their previous debts, raise the interest until suddenly people are living well beyond their means, borrowing money they can't pay for. In their thirst for money, the wealthy encourage others to borrow more and more, raising the interest on the loans, driving people into poverty. Thus, the city becomes split into two classes, the rich and the poor. It is no longer a state with harmony between rulers and ruled. It is at war with itself. Long before Karl Marx, Plato describes class warfare. In such a state, the rulers and their son become self-indulgent. So Plato asks, are not the young people luxurious and lazy in manners of body and soul? The poor come to realize how weak the rich really are. Eventually, the class conflict turns into outright warfare. So democracy now comes along. I suppose, he says, democracy comes into being when the poor conquer and kill some of the other party and others and share out the citizenship and government equally with the rest and offers it in general and generally are settled by lot. Public offices in Greek idea of democracy were more chosen by lottery than by elections, much as we pick juries, which some have in fact argued would be a more reasonable way to do things because you'd have a much better representation of the people. If you pick 500 members of the House of Representatives by lottery, you'd have about 50% women. You'd have probably a pretty close proportionate number of each group. The more I see, the more I begin to think about that idea. You'd also get rid of all this pressure to raise money for campaigns.
And fewer felons, too.
Pardon?
Fewer felons in Congress.
Yeah. With the overthrow of the oligarchy, democracy now has replaced it. The new constitution is written. Now no longer willing to be ruled by others who exploit them, the citizens demand freedom. Freedom, however, no longer means the power to rule oneself, as the philosopher does. It now becomes the right to do whatever one wants to do. With each pursuing his own appetites and no care for anything else, chaos ensues. Plato describes this situation quite vividly, and you've probably heard this quote before. The father gets into the habit of behaving like the son and fears his own children. The son behaves like a father and does not honor or fear his parents. Must have liberty, he says. And there are these other trifles too, I said. Teachers fear pupil in such a state of things, and plays the toady. Pupils despise their teachers and tutors. And in general, the young imitate their elders in word and deed, and old men give way to the young. They're all complacent and wiggling and behave like young men themselves so as not to be thought disagreeable or dictatorial. In such a society, there eventually emerges three classes. One, the most orderly, busy making money, becoming eventually the richest group in the democracy. Another is the largest group, the handy workers, the craftsmen, and so forth, without much wealth. And the third is the class of the idle and extravagant men themselves, who are consumers but not producers. Plato calls them the drones, who produce no honey but consume. Some are harmless, but some have stingers. In an oligarchy, they are kept in check. But in a democracy, with its unrestrained liberty, they increase in numbers. The workers busy earning a living are generally non-political. As the ruler takes property from those who have it to distribute it among the drones, however, eventually there is a reaction. Those being plundered are driven to defend themselves. When they speak out and take what action they can, they are accused of plotting against the people. Class warfare breaks out in full. Soon there is complete anarchy. A leader puts himself forward as the protector of the people. The people's protector demands now a bodyguard because he's afraid of the wealthier classes. To protect him, and he demands emergency powers to bring order out of anarchy. We need go no further to see how democracy has led to tyranny. Plato summarizes very nicely as coming through the lack of restraint. He says, "So then oligarchy was destroyed by the insatiate desire for riches and disregard of anything else for the sake of money making." True, said he. Then is democracy also dissolved by insatiate desire for that which it defines as good? What do you say it so defines? Liberty, I said. That is, I suppose, you would always hear it as the most beautiful in the democratic city, and therefore this is the only city where a man of free nature thinks life is worth living. Oh, yes, he said, that would be on every tongue. It is true, then, as I was going to say, that the insatiate desire for this and disregard for everything else transforms the Constitution here also and makes it want a tyranny. Well, Plato wrote the Republic not so much as a political treatise, as the title might suggest, and some of my colleagues teach it. He wrote it as a moral treatise. At least my interpretation of the Republic is, why should we be moral? But for later discussion. We have seen that Plato's view of moderation includes self-restraint and harmony. There must be harmony in which the rational part rules and restrain and the lower parts and urges and appetites. This concords with the Philebus, where reason is with the Phaedrus, where reason is portrayed as the charioteer steering and keeping under control the two horses of passion and desire. The driver must restrain the horses, keep them from getting in their heads and turning off in different directions. Only when there is harmony of driver and horses working together can the chariot be successful. The same is true of the three parts of the soul in the state. Unfortunately, this picture tends to depict moderation simply as avoiding excess, keeping things in check. Plato himself observes, and this is one of my favorite passages from the Republic, to do anything too much tends to take you to the opposite extreme, in weather and in plants and in living bodies, and so also in the constitution most of all. I came to appreciate the importance of this from my Uncle Larry. Uncle Larry believed that if something is good, more of it is better. If the directions were to take 2 aspirin, he would take 4. One day his wife bought a dozen raspberry bushes and asked him to take care of them. The directions said to plant each one with 1/2 cup of fertilizer. Well, Uncle Larry decided that if 1/2 cup was good, 3 full cups would be much better. As you can guess, the bushes were all dead within a week. Too much of a good thing is not good, but leads to the opposite result of what was intended. I recall a classmate in graduate school. He was the son of a minister who had raised him very strictly, according to his religious beliefs. The student, once away from home, had become an atheist. We all know of athletes who, under pressure, try too hard, and as a result, choke up. Too much of a good thing. Plato's student Aristotle has a slightly different view. Aristotle treats temperance, or sophrosyne, as just one of the virtues. A virtue here is understood by Aristotle as the habit of seeking the mean, or mesos, between excess and deficiency in a particular type of acting. In facing danger, courage is the mean between rashness and cowardice. Temperance, then, he restricts, sophrosyne, to the mean between extremes in satisfying our appetites for food and drink. The temperate man avoids overindulgence and gluttony with food and drink, but he also avoids the other extremes of too little food or drink. It is interesting that today temperance is often used to mean complete abstinence, and particularly from drink, as in the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which want you to take a pledge not to drink at all. That's not temperance for Socrates. Even the term moderately has come to mean simply not overdoing it, a lesser amount. But Aristotle points out, men who are deficient in enjoyment of bodily pleasures are indeed rare, so there's no special name for them, for this particular state. He calls it being insensitive. Hence also the tendency to identify moderation primarily with excess. While it is true that Aristotle limits sophrosyne, or temperance, to pleasure and pain, in fact he does not limit moderation to these. Each of his moral virtues is a form of moderation, for it seeks the mean, the mesos, between the two extremes. Each is a disposition to seek the mean of a particular sphere of action or feeling. It is not a precise mathematical mean, but the mean relative to each person as a reasonable man would determine it. It's one of my favorite passages in all of philosophy. This reveals a great deal about Aristotle's ethics. His ethics is based on his understanding of man as the zoon logon ekon, an animal with reason, a rational animal. Ethics is living as a rational animal. First, a good man acts reasonably in satisfying his animal nature. So the moral virtues are the search for moderation. That's what's reasonable. But secondly, the highest happiness of man lies in the exercise of the intellectual virtues, the very fulfillment of intelligence itself, namely in contemplation. So for Aristotle, the idea is rooted in the very notion of being reasonable. Reason, for Aristotle, however, is much richer concept than the reason as understood by the 16th century rationalist. It does provide absolute standards. We say be reasonable and seek the mean. However, what is reasonable, that is the rational mean, is different for different persons and in different situations. Their theoretical reason judges that we should drive safely, neither too slow nor too fast. But what is too slow on a freeway may well be too fast in a school zone. Practical reason must judge this in each case. Thus, Aristotle and Plato both arrive at the same conclusion: we should act with moderation. There are, however, important differences between them. For Plato, moderation means restraining the passions and appetites. For Aristotle, it is more nuanced. It means avoiding both extremes of excess and deficiency. Both would agree that it means being governed by reason. Reason, however, is a little different for each of them. Plato would hold that reason rules the lower part when it judges actions according to the idea of the good. Aristotle rejects the idea of the good on the grounds that the good has many different meanings. It's a relative term, not an absolute. Reason, for Aristotle, acts by recognizing the order of things and measuring its acts in accord with it. As the previous speaker was talking, living in harmony with the world or with reality. Thus, there is a harmony here also for Aristotle, but a different one than for Plato. Plato's harmony is the coherence within oneself under the guidance of reason, but of a reason judging by a certain higher standard. Aristotle considers acting virtuously to be a harmony of our actions with reality under the guidance of reason. Acting according to reality. Speaking of the tempered man, he says, but such pleasures as conduce to health and fitness he will try to obtain in a moderate and right degree, as also other pleasures, so far as they are not detrimental to health and fitness, and not ignoble, nor beyond his means. The man who exceeds in these limit cases more for such pleasure, cares more for pleasure than they are really worth. In other words, he puts a proper estimation on things. The worth of these pleasures is judged not by our feelings, nor by the ideal good, but by their relation to the realities of life. There is room for self-indulgence, both in Plato and Aristotle, but it must be guided by reason, as each of them understands it. Whether man or state, the one who cannot restrain himself but demands unbridled self-gratification has become irrational. It is interesting to note that the Greek term for moderation, sophrosyne, etymologically means moral sanity. The immoderate man is morally insane. This is why Plato says that the tyrant is like an insane person. He's aware of that etymology. Such a one is out of control. He has become enslaved by less noble parts. Thus, freedom is not, as my students think, being able to do what one feels like, but being able to govern oneself, or self-control, or self-restraint. Well, I started my title talking about self-denial. Where does that come in? This is really more of a Christian than a Greek term. However, the roots of it certainly can be found in Greek thought. In the Phaedo, Socrates tells us that the philosopher practices death in the sense that he tries to free his soul of the demands of the body as far as possible. there's here implicitly a kind of self-denial. But the idea of self-denial, I think, is more accommodating to Aristotle's ethics, for Aristotle treats virtue as a habit which must be acquired by repeated practice, repetition, and practice. It's not just a judgment in an individual case, it's acquiring a certain habit. I believe that to acquire real self-restraint or self-control, for any virtue, one must at times practice self-denial. We can profit greatly, I think, by reflecting on Plato's discussion of the destruction of the state as well as the individual by lack of moderation. There's a lot to be learned from this. At the same time, Aristotle's understanding of reason is much more helpful in understanding how the lack of moderation is both self-destructive and socially destructive. If moderation is acting in harmony with reality, then it is clear that lack of moderation has tragic results. If we live in a society which believes that all law, we live in a society that believes that all laws are arbitrary, that we can change a thing merely by redefining it. Students regularly tell me that truth is whatever we believe it to be, but that's not the real world. In the real world, we act on our beliefs and our acts have consequences. There is one undeniable truth in the Bible. As you sow, so you shall reap. In that real world, lack of moderation has drastic consequences. If we eat too little, we become undernourished and subject to illness, which even possibly can end up with death. If we eat too much, we become obese, which leads to all kinds of health problems. In raising our children, if we overindulge them, they become self-centered and resentful. If we are too strict, they become rebellious. If we spend too little, we lead a miserable life, a miserly life. If we spend more than we can afford, we go bankrupt. In our country, however, we are given more to self-indulgence than self-denial, too much rather than too little. Our contemporary culture, in the name of freedom and tolerance, sanctions any form of self-indulgence, including narcissism, excessive entertainment, lack of discipline, pornography, promiscuous sex, drug abuse, overconsumption, and even excessive debt. This is the situation that Plato describes as democracy. Freedom has come to mean doing whatever we feel like. We stress the autonomy of the individual, as though our actions affect only ourselves. But no man is an island unto himself. There are no victimless crimes. There are no private vices. A politician's lust for power leads to catering to the self-indulgence of his constituency. A banker's greed can destroy the banking system. Innocent people have lost their jobs, their homes, or their pensions as a result of other people's greed, of other people's lack of moderation. If each one insists on doing their own thing in the name of freedom, society cannot live in harmony. We reach the state of anarchy that Plato predicts as a result of immoderate exercise of freedom. At that point, there are only two possibilities. We can either restore the ideal of freedom as self-restraint, self-government, or we can look for a leader who will restrain us. As Plato predicts, we will lapse into tyranny. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernard.